In 1966, in the sleepy town of Oudendalsrus in the Free State, two 12-year-old girls, cousins Isifori and Petronelle, are kidnapped and murdered. Issy's brother vows to leave no stone unturned in his quest for justice for his sister and cousin. And although it would take more than 20 years, he kept that promise. But the fallout of the brutal murders would take its toll regardless, and the families and communities involved would never be the same. In a brand new drama series based on these true crime events, CakeNet explores this case in the series Nichies. A new episode of Nichies airs every Tuesday on CakeNet, DSTV channel 144 at 8 p.m. and you can catch up with any episodes you've missed on DSTV Stream and Catch Up. The wind ripples through the maize field. Driving past on the road, it's a beautiful, serene scene. You'd never know that deep within the crop lies a secret. A terrible truth, just waiting to be uncovered. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 185, The Serial Crimes of Muketsi Ramasa. Today's episode is proudly sponsored by Dial-A-Bed, South Africa's go-to destination for quality sleep. With 83 stores nationwide and a convenient online store, getting the rest you deserve has never been easier. Visit www.dialabed.co.za and wake up to a better you. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes, you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Cheryl Durham, Chantal Bruver, Alzette Farr, Tracy, Carol Cross, Renal Dupria, Vanna Liesel Bruver, Odette Smith, Diana Pillay, Tion Smith Shedden, Maritza Latakhan, Natalie, Jen, Helen Terry, Teresa Null, Yanni Kutzer, Bianca Kidson, and Charlize Pretorius for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a big difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Over the last few weeks, I've been talking a lot about my most recent book, Killer Stories, which I co-authored with Dr. Bryn Hodgkiss. The book focuses predominantly on serial offenders and their psychology. And when I was being interviewed on Hot FM about it recently, I mentioned how South Africa came to be really good at catching serial killers in the 1990s and early 2000s. That comment got a lot of attention and reminded me that there are still so many serial cases from that time I haven't covered on the podcast. I also followed up that comment, though, with a caveat that we can only be really good at catching serial killers if the investigating officers at ground level are supported in their individual investigations. Because no one knows they're dealing with the serial killer until the trend is identified. And that can only happen if each and every murder is thoroughly investigated. And I think today's case exhibits both those things. It shows how serial killers can get away with their crimes for far too long when individual IOs aren't doing their job or are unable to due to a lack of resources. And it also shows how quickly someone trained in serial offender investigation can track down and apprehend a serial killer. My sources for today's episode include a chapter from Dr. Mickey Pistorius's book, Strangers on the Street, and several digital resources, including a study on the frequency of strangulation in sexually motivated murders. So let's get into episode 185, The Serial Crimes of Muketsi Ramaisa.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
As you'll have become sadly used to in serial murder cases, I don't have a lot of information about the victims in this case. Someone once told me when I was lamenting how we always know the serial killer's name and background and almost never the victims, that they think families often don't want their loved ones' names out in the public domain linked to a serial killer because there's some sort of stigma around that. I don't agree with that. And I've never encountered a victim's family who didn't want their loved one's name out there for that reason, regardless of how they died. Certainly some families are less likely to want to engage in the public domain in greater detail, and that's certainly understandable, but I've never encountered someone experiencing shame around their loved one having been killed by a serial offender. Either way, we know very little about the deceased victims in this case. Thankfully, we do know their names and their ages, and a little about the area they lived in, and can therefore surmise what their lives may have been like. The area in which the series occurred, Kroonstad in the Free State province of South Africa, came onto my radar recently when I was doing research on the case I covered in episode 184. So when I saw this case occurred there, I already knew at least one thing I hadn't originally known about the town. During the Second Boer War between 1899 and 1902, Kroonstad became the capital of what was then known as the Orange Free State, and subsequently the site of a concentration camp to contain Boer women and children. These camps were set up to house people who'd been driven away from their homes by the British scorched earth policy of the time. Various camps were set up throughout different parts of the country for this purpose, and they were racially segregated. So the Kroonstad camp was for European settlers only, and some of the other camps housed only African people who'd been living or working on the properties seized by the British at that time. All of these camps became deadly places for those housed in them, with tens of thousands of people eventually dying from disease and malnutrition by the time the camps were closed. The vast majority of the dead were children. Going backward in history, though, before Kruonstadt became the site of a concentration camp, its origin story is pretty interesting and also a little tragic. Kruonstadt was established in 1855 by an Irish man named Joseph Orpin. And while many may think that the town's name is a reference to it being the crown of the Free State, in that Kruon means crown in Afrikaans, it's actually named after Orpin's horse. The man was apparently a huge animal lover, and when his beloved horse drowned in a body of water shortly after they'd arrived in the town that would soon be settled, he decided to honour his fallen companion by naming the town after him. Today, Kruonstadt is a predominantly agricultural town, producing maize, wheat, dairy, and meat products, as well as wool. And it would be in the maize fields that surround Kruonstadt in 1997 that a horror story would begin to unravel. The series of murders began as many do, with the perpetrator being arrested for rape and then released, and that perpetrator leaving prison, or in this case, court, and vowing to never leave a victim alive to tell the tale again. On the 12th of April 1997, a 13-year-old girl was walking home through the maize field on the farm on which she and her family lived when a man appeared out of nowhere and attempted to tackle her to the ground. The girl screamed and started running, but the man chased her down and dragged her deeper into the fields, out of sight of any passers-by. There, the girl's legs and hands were bound, and the man gagged her with a piece of material so she couldn't scream. The girl was subjected to rape for hours, until eventually the man placed his hands around her throat and strangled her. When she lost consciousness, the perpetrator, believing he'd killed her, walked away, leaving her lying in the field. But the girl was not dead, and she regained consciousness a short while later. This is not at all uncommon for killers who were not used to strangling victims. While the movies may make strangulation seem like a quick way to kill someone, it takes an average of 4 to 5 minutes of continued strangulation to actually kill someone that way. What tends to catch inexperienced killers out is that the victim will lose consciousness very quickly. This is the body's way of protecting the organs from damage due to reduced oxygen levels in the blood. And if the perpetrator takes the unconsciousness to mean that the victim is dead and removes their hands or a ligature from the throat, breathing will resume, albeit shallow enough for the perpetrator to perhaps not notice. This is why we so often see a combination of strangling and some other more violent form of killing at murder scenes, especially in intimate partner murders and sexually motivated murders. The killer will often back off and start doing something else, perhaps cleaning up evidence or figuring out their next move. And then the victim will suddenly regain consciousness, and the perpetrator will grab the closest thing to kill them. Strangulation is often combined with blunt force trauma or stabbing as a method of killing, for this very reason. In this case, though, the young victim was relieved to find that her attacker had left the scene, and the brave girl was able to make her way home with her bindings still around her limbs. When her horrified parents discovered what had happened, they immediately called the police, and the girl was transported to hospital for a rape kit to be conducted and for treatment. Quickly, though, she informed the police officers that she knew her attacker. He lived in a village near the farm where she lived, and he worked as a taxi driver. She'd seen him transporting people between the farms and town regularly. His name was Mukhetsi Ramaisa. Ramaisa was arrested and charged with several counts of rape, as well as kidnapping. Sadly, a technicality resulted in Ramaisa being acquitted, and he was released. Now the young girl who had so bravely fought to survive and tell her story had to live in fear, regularly seeing her attacker in town. As for the people of Kruenstadt, they too should have been living in fear. But acquittal on a technicality was confusing to many. And for the most part, residents believed Ramaisa had been wrongly accused, and that was why he'd been acquitted. Their assumptions would prove fatally incorrect. On the 11th of August 1997, a woman walking through the maize fields of Gelukskraal Farm in Kruenstadt stumbled upon the decomposed remains of a woman. The victim, who would later be identified as 19-year-old Sophia Maria Ngatane, was lying face down, wearing only a t-shirt and bra, which had been pulled up to her neck. Her remains were very badly decomposed when she was found, and some of her fingers and toes were missing, likely as a result of animal activity. Her head had also become partially detached from her body, but the pathologist would later determine that this had not been done by the killer and was as a result of decomposition and also possibly animal and insect activity. Although a cause of death could not be determined due to the level of decomposition, Sophia being found without any clothes on her lower body does speak to a sexually motivated crime. And I do wonder whether she may have been strangled and the damage to that tissue in her neck accelerated the decomposition in that area and allowed for increased insect activity and eventually damage by animals. After police had managed to identify Sophia, they discovered that the young woman was last seen alive in April 1997. In cases like this, where decomposition is so advanced, it's almost impossible to tell exactly when a victim was murdered. So information like this is key to creating a timeline. And it's at this point that I must address the fact that we don't know whether Sophia, or really any of the victims to come in this series, were ever reported missing. While it's possible she was, and a missing persons investigation went nowhere, it's also possible she wasn't reported missing. And if you're thinking, well, 5 months is a pretty long time to just disappear without anyone noticing, especially for a 19-year-old, yes, I would agree with that. But we also need to take this in the context of the time. In 1997, we were just 3 years out from the official fall of apartheid and the rise of democracy in our country, which, among a myriad of other things, gave all South Africans the right to move freely throughout the country without their movements being questioned or them being detained. This is one of the points I mentioned in that interview I spoke about earlier on, because it was this free movement of larger groups of people in South Africa that had an unexpected consequence. When people were finally free to move around for work and other opportunities, they would often lose contact with their families for long periods of time. This was the mid-90s, so we basically had landlines and mail, and the majority of people in South Africa did not have access to even those most basic of communication methods. So if someone left their hometown to look for work in other parts of the country, they may not have been in contact with their family for many months. If they didn't form any lasting connections with people in their new location, no one may notice they'd disappeared for months, sometimes even years. Of course, their families would be concerned if they didn't hear from them for an extended period of time, but for the most part, they wouldn't have even had the first idea where to start looking, because their loved one could have ended up anywhere. This is one of the main reasons that we saw a huge rise in serial murders around this time in our country's history. because it wasn't just honest and ordinary folk who were able to finally take advantage of freedom of movement, but also people with more insidious intentions. Murderers saw that there was now a large group of people vulnerable by virtue of their distance from family and their search for employment, and came out of the woodwork in huge numbers. This was when South Africa began to develop its skills in serial investigation and formed the Investigative Psychology Unit and began to train detectives on the ground to identify the indicators of serial murder. With that said, although we know so little about Sophia Ngatane, it would not entirely surprise me if she was not reported missing. Either way, it was very clear that Sophia had crossed paths with a predator, and it seemed that very little was done to investigate her murder. Months passed with no resolution in the case. The new year dawned, and in May 1998, another body was found. On the 8th of May 1998, the body of 7-year-old Dibuseng Tuetsi was discovered by a young boy who'd been herding livestock on the farm Miliplas. Dibuseng had disappeared on her way home from school 2 weeks before. Again, there was no information about any searches for her or a missing persons investigation, although I'm assuming because she was a minor, it would likely have been slightly different than with Sophia. Dibuseng was still wearing her school uniform, but her school belt had been removed and used to tie her hands. It was also wrapped around her neck, and ligature strangulation would later be determined as her cause of death. There were indications of a rape having occurred as well. At this point, although an investigating officer was assigned to investigate this murder, there was no indication that anyone suspected Dibuseng's murder was in any way linked to either Sophia's, the previous year, or the rape and attempted murder of the 13-year-old girl. 2 months later, the body of 12-year-old Mita Naong was found on the farm Skoongesicht. Mita had disappeared on the 24th of May 1998 when she'd left her grandmother's house where she lived to visit her aunt. She never arrived. Mita was still clothed in the floral dress she'd been wearing when she disappeared, and she was wearing her shoes, but her underwear had been removed, and the blood-stained panties were found close to her body. An attempt had been made to cover the child's body with vegetation, and tire tracks were noted near the body, which made police suspect that either the child had not been killed there, or she had been abducted elsewhere and transported to the scene by car. Very often, it's not the police that points to the possibility of a serial killer, at least publicly. In many cases, it's someone linked to a neighbourhood watch, for instance, or a journalist, or anyone else who, besides not being bound by the desire to keep phrases like serial killer under wraps, also have a more holistic view of what's happening in an area. While a police officer might have more of a myopic view, only seeing their cases or their station's cases, for instance, people who have greater dealings with the community or area as a whole are often more likely to spot similarities in cases or victims. This sort of thing often happens within the circle of law enforcement professionals too, where people in certain roles, like forensic artists who draw up identikits, or forensic pathologists who see the bodies of victims from a larger area, may identify similarities in cases that police may have missed. In this case, it was a teacher who was aware of the various cases involving children at both primary and high schools in the area who first publicly made the links and spoke to a journalist about it. The woman said in an article that it was very clear to her that there was a serial rapist and murderer targeting young girls and women in Kroonstad, and similarities between the victims and how they were killed could not be ignored. The article called on police to take action and form a task team to investigate the series of murders. From the outside, at least, this did not appear to push police into action, at least not immediately. What it did do, though, was alert the killer, who then seemed to stop killing for a while. This is a rare reaction to a series being exposed in the media. Very often, knowing that they're under investigation can actually fuel the killer to start killing even more often. Only very rarely are they able to stop entirely for any long period of time to strategically avoid capture, unless they're outside of their comfort zone for some reason, in prison or bedridden from illness. But thankfully for any future victims, this individual did seem to stop killing. And for a while, the people of Kroonstadt could focus solely on mourning their lost women and children. Almost 7 months after the last victim's body was found in Kroonstadt, the investigative psychology unit became aware of the cases there. The unit was at that time headed up by Dr. Mickey Pistorius, and she and her colleagues confirmed that there were enough similarities between the various victims and the crimes committed against them to say that a single offender was likely responsible for all of the identified crimes. The IPU suggested that all the cases be handed over to a detective who'd been trained in serial offender investigations at the closest murder and robbery unit to the crime scenes, which in this case was Bloemfontein. And that is how in January 1999, the dockets landed on the desk of Superintendent Kurt Faree. In the second week of January, Faree travelled out to Kroonstadt after having assessed the murder dockets he'd been given. He'd asked the officers at Kroonstadt to pull any rape complaints they'd had within a year of the first murder. Among those dockets was the case of the 13-year-old girl who'd been kidnapped, brutally raped, and strangled. Her case was technically closed because the most likely perpetrator, Muketsi Ramaisa, was acquitted on a technicality and therefore could not be retried for that case, no matter what evidence was found. The circumstances of that case, though, were so eerily similar to the murder cases that Faree had to bring Ramaisa in for questioning. Faree arrived at Ramaisa's home where he lived with his wife and two daughters and asked the man if he would come down to the station to chat with them. Ramaisa agreed, and on the drive, Faree chatted with the man about his life. Ramaisa told him that he worked as a taxi driver in the area, and he and his wife had lost two children soon after they were born due to deformities in their craniums, which had resulted in brain damage. By the time they got to the police station, Ramaisa seemed relaxed. Faree informed him of his rights and explained to him that he was aware of the case of rape and attempted murder that Ramaisa had been acquitted on. Faree then explained that there'd been several murders in the area which seemed strangely similar to that attack, and he wondered if Ramaisa knew anything about those victims. After a short period of silence, during which Ramaisa seemed to consider his options, he admitted that he did know about those murders. It was him who'd killed the victims. Ramaisa claimed that Sophia Ngatane had agreed to have sex with him, and they'd gone into the fields to do so. Although he did not admit to having committed the rape and attempted murder of the 13-year-old girl, he did admit that he'd killed Sophia while he was out on bail for that first offence. Ramaisa said that while he and Sophia had been having sex, he'd become aroused by the idea of strangling her, and he'd proceeded to do just that. Having learned from his first crime, he used a ligature this time, and not his hands, so he could apply more pressure to the victim's neck for a longer period. He admitted that he'd killed Sophia. He further admitted to raping and killing both Dibuseng Tsuetsi and Mita Ngaung. He, of course, could not claim that these victims had consented to sex because they were minors. Oddly, and it's not the first time I've seen this with a serial killer, Ramasa seemed to really want to gloss over the rapes, while not really having a problem admitting to the murders. And although this might be because most of his victims were minors, and he might think there could be a stigma around that in prison, I don't personally believe Sophia consented to have sex with him either. Ramasa was not a man looking for consensual sex. He was a predator. He told Superintendent Faree how, by the time he'd killed his second victim, he became more sexually aroused by how his victim's eyes changed as they died than anything else about the crimes, including the rapes. This makes it even more surprising to me that he was able to not kill for almost 7 months after the announcement was made that a serial killer was on the loose, and also makes me wonder whether, as a taxi driver with his own vehicle, perhaps he was actually just moving into other areas to commit crimes, and they weren't linked back to him. If his fixation had not been the way he killed, but rather the moment of death itself, he may well have been able to change up his MO and signatures just enough to avoid any other cases being linked to this series, especially if they were far enough away from Kroonstadt that the same officers wouldn't necessarily be aware of them. But Ramasa did not admit to any additional crimes, and in early 2000 he was brought to trial in Virginia. Prosecutor Advocate Elise LaRue appeared for the state, and Advocate Ilse Potgieter represented Ramasa before Judge van Kopenhagen. Although he was charged with the rape and murder of all three victims, it would prove difficult for the state to show that he had most definitely raped Sophia, because her body was so badly decomposed it was impossible to assess damage to the genitalia and attempt to distinguish between a consensual sex act and possible rape in that way. On that note, I must of course say that not all rapes leave visible damage. The body protects itself from damage as much as possible, and so lubrication can often be produced even in a rape situation, simply as a biological function. Even if Sophia's body had not been decomposed, there may have been no absolute proof that she was raped. But with no biological evidence at all, the judge eventually had to find Ramasa not guilty on that charge. He was, however, found guilty of Sophia's murder, as well as the rapes and murders of Dibuseng Tsuetsi and Mita Ngaung. In 2001, Muketsi Ramasa was handed down 3 life sentences for the murders, as well as additional years for the rape charges, which would be served concurrently with the life sentences. In an interesting development for the time, as I haven't really seen this a lot in cases prior to 2004, Muketsi Ramasa was also assessed for the dangerous offender determination. And this was handed down as a classification to him. This means that rather than becoming eligible for parole in 2024, he will have to appear before a judge in 2029, and the judge will determine whether he may be eligible for parole at that time. There's no mention of how old Ramasa was at the time of his arrest, but from the information available and the knowledge that most serial killers start killing in their late 20s or early 30s, it's likely that by 2029, if he is still alive, Ramasa will be in his 60s. When he is 65, if he has not yet been paroled, he will be eligible to apply for release based on his age. But considering his dangerous offender determination, that will hopefully not be on the table for him. Although there are not nearly as many victims in this case as we have seen in some serial murder cases in South Africa, it does seem, to me at least, to be a good example of just how badly and how well a serial case can be handled. If Lamaisa had not been acquitted on that first attack, 3 lives could have been saved. But he wouldn't have been in prison forever, and it's very likely that when he was released from whatever determinate sentence he was given for that case, he would have started his series regardless. On the other side of this, had it not been for Faree's quick work after having been given the dockets, Ramaisa may well have continued on with his series once the dust had settled on the serial killer claims. And many, many more may have lost their lives. This case is just one of the many serial cases in our country's history. Just 3 of the victims who have fallen to perhaps the most feared of criminals. Kirsten Clark, who I interviewed on the podcast when she still worked for the IPU and who is now in private practice, estimates that at any given time in South Africa, there are between 50 and 60 active serial offenders. Many of these are serial rapists, but some are serial killers too. And some will progress from one to the other during their series. That number is incredibly chilling. There are 60 Muketsi Ramaisas out there right now, hunting for their next victim. And their victims are just girls and boys, men and women, going about their daily lives, walking to school, to their aunts' houses, to work, to the shops, never having any idea that they are being watched by a predator. Sophia Ngetane, Dibuseng Tuetsi, and Mita Naung, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.